I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Friday, April 2nd. If you've consumed a lot of mainstream press over the last 2 days, you might think the only debate over President Biden's multi-trillion dollar infrastructure plan is between Republicans who think it's too big and Democrats who think it's just right. But truth is, there's another debate that's also emerging between Biden Democrats who do think the plan is right-sized and more progressive Democrats who think it's too small in the number of dollars and not as transformational as Biden likes to portray it as in climate terms and in human terms. Here is Bronx and Queens Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez on MSNBC.
First of all, you know, this is $2.25 trillion over 8 years. For context, because these huge numbers are hard to understand, for context, we passed an almost $2 trillion COVID relief package that's supposed to last us 1 year with some provisions lasting up to 2 years. So the $1,400 stimulus checks, that big package that we felt in our lives, were deployed on a shorter timeline. So I think that if we need to really have some shorter timelines, some urgency, greater urgency in this package, and I think that some of these investments need to be greater.
AOC with Rachel Maddow on MSNBC. She also uses an example from her own backyard to put the scope of the spending and what she sees as the scope of the need into context.
This plan, this Build Back Better plan, it advocates for a total national investment of $40 billion in public housing nationwide. Sounds great, right? Except when you consider the fact that the New York City public housing system needs $40 billion alone just to get up to code.
And so if Biden has his American Jobs Plan, as he calls the bill he introduced Wednesday, the Congressional Progressive Caucus has its own bill, which they call the Thrive Act. So with that as a starting point, we'll welcome now a leading voice for as progressive an infrastructure package as possible, including the Thrive Act. And that means both physical infrastructure in the American Jobs Plan, as he calls it, unveiled this week, and the human infrastructure spending that Biden will officially unveil later this month, including free community college, more family leave, and other things aimed at fighting long-term economic inequality, as well as the so-called she-cession. Have you heard that word, she-cession? People are calling this the pandemic downturn in the economy that has hit women much harder than men. Our guest is Nalini Stamp, the Brooklyn-based National Director of Strategy and Partnerships for the Working Families Party. She's been an economic justice activist since the Great Recession of 2008. That was more of a man's session. A leader in the Occupy movement that followed thereafter, and more. She and the rest of the Working Families Party are holding events this week and next week as part of what they call Recovery Recess, to tell members of Congress to at least vote for the Biden bills and to push for more. Nalini, thanks so much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
It's lovely to be here.
Would you start by telling us in general terms what you like about the Biden jobs plan the party unveiled this week and what you think misses the mark?
The protection for labor unions and the right to organize, the investment in the caring economy. So domestic workers, care workers, healthcare workers, those are really great things. But Biden's plan is wrong on the scale. It's the absolute floor, not the ceiling. $2.3 trillion over 8 years won't create enough jobs to put people back to work because we're still living in the aftermath of the 2008 recession or man session. And we continue to live crises to crises. So we know that we need a plan that creates 15 million jobs for people across the country, that'll create at least 400,000 jobs for New Yorkers alone. And it takes a plan that's gonna invest enough money to actually avert the climate crisis and make the people most affected by our country's past harms that are not just cared for, but actually prioritized.
So these numbers can be mind-boggling. $2 trillion, then with the Part 2 rollout that's expected, $4 trillion, the Thrive Act that you're advocating, $10 trillion, kind of abstract also. So would you give us a sense of some specifics of the Thrive Act? Like, what are some of the most important things in there that aren't in the Biden bills?
There's some obvious ones like electric vehicles, modernizing and retrofitting buildings that are in the Biden plan, and clean energy generation and transmission. But there are also ones that don't get talked about as much, like a regenerative agriculture, forest and wetland restoration, and actually investing even more in our care infrastructure. And those are pivotal parts of the Thrive Act. And we have lots of people, more than 300 unions, racial justice, indigenous, climate, progressive, and grassroots organizations that joined forces for the Thrive Act. And it matches the best parts of Biden's package, like the setting of new standards of workers' rights with the PRO Act, making sure Black and Brown people across the country finally have clean water to drink. But what it fills is the massive gaps left in Biden's package. So it's $1 trillion a year for the next 10 years to put people back to work. We need to actually get to full employment, which is what the Thrive Act is trying to do and puts in the plan as a center. Biden's plan will not get us to full employment, and we need to get there again, not just because of what we've lost in the pandemic, but to actually recover and right the wrongs of our past, of economic inequality that has been on the burden, on the backs of working people. Our people have to always continue to be first responders. They continue to have to start GoFundMes for funerals. And we want to correct that. And those are the key pieces that are in the Thrive Act.
Nalini, you used a term that I know is being talked about in this context, but that might be new to a lot of listeners. So I wonder if you could expound on it a little bit. And that is the term, the care infrastructure. What is the care infrastructure?
We've always looked at infrastructure as bridges, roads, public necessities and utilities that we need for our communities. One of the things that, and the National Domestic Workers have led on this for a really long time, is the care infrastructure. And what that means is investing in our caring economy. So our healthcare workers and our home aides, we need to make sure that people are getting good pay, union jobs in our caring economy. This means making sure that our hospitals, nurses, all of the folks who have been the frontline workers taking care of our communities throughout this crisis don't have to feel like they have nothing. They were struggling for PPE in the beginning. I remember when folks were wearing garbage bags. I remember when my uncle, who unfortunately passed away from COVID, was in and out of the hospital and talking about the conditions when he still could, about what he was seeing. Investing in a care infrastructure and a care economy means to make sure that our hospitals are good, that we have elderly care, in-home care, all of the things that the burden has been on women in particular in this crisis, in this last year. That is what caring infrastructure looks like. What does it look like to have childcare for everyone? What does it look like to make sure we prioritize care as a public and common good? That's what we mean by the care infrastructure.
On jobs, the monthly jobs report came out this morning, as it does on the first Friday of every month. And it showed a whopping net gain of 916,000 jobs in March, credited largely to the vaccines, making people feel it's safer to reopen more of the economy. And some economists say a big jobs plan per se isn't really needed because the demand and desire are there on the part of employers. So to the extent that we succeed against the pandemic, the job market will largely take care of itself. That's the argument. How much do you agree or disagree with that?
This goes back to what was normal before the pandemic and taking away the previous administration, Trump's administration. We can't go back to normal. Millions of people were still trying to survive paycheck to paycheck. We had still millions of people who were unemployed, lots of folks who were struggling to pay their rent before this pandemic hit, before this crisis hit. It has been a long time coming that economic inequality has been brutal to our communities, to working people across the country. And so for us and for me, like, we actually need to invest in jobs, not just because of what happened in the pandemic, right? It is a big part of it, but not just because, but so we can actually go back and repair historic harms. The historic harms of Black and Brown people and Indigenous people continuously suffering from economic crisis. The historic harm that in the 2008 financial crisis, 60% of the wealth was taken from Black and Brown communities through that crisis. And so it is really, 60% of wealth was taken from the Black community in specificity. So it is important that we don't treat this as, oh, we can go back to normal, because normal was not working for millions of working people in this country.
Here's another clip of Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez responding to the Biden proposal on Rachel Maddow on MSNBC Wednesday night. And then I want to ask you about a particular piece of this coming out of it.
If we're looking at ideals and what we think is the actual investment that can create tens of millions of good union jobs in this country, that can shore up our healthcare, our infrastructure, our housing, and doing it in a way that draws down our carbon emissions to help us get in line with the IPCC standards, we're talking about realistically $10 trillion over 10 years. And I know that may be an eye-popping figure for some people, but we need to understand that we are in a devastating economic moment. Millions of people in the United States are unemployed. We have a truly crippled healthcare system and a planetary crisis on our hands, and we're the wealthiest nation in the history of the world.
So there's that $10 trillion figure again over 10 years. But what I really want to ask you about next is the very beginning of that clip where she talked about it creating a lot of union jobs. And Biden is very much a pro-union guy. And there are pro-union elements in his Jobs Act. Are you familiar with those? Because obviously the Working Families Party, your party, very much a function of the labor movement, very related to the labor movement. So what do you see here that's important, that's union related?
There are key elements of the PRO Act in the American Jobs Plan, and we have them in the Thrive Act. And the PRO Act means the Protect the Right to Organize, which is so critical. We're seeing it unfold in Bessemer, Alabama now, where workers are trying to unionize, again, in an Amazon facility. And because of the state's right to work laws, because of these right to work laws that have expanded across the country, workers don't have the dignity to demand bathroom breaks. That is the level of where we're at. And so the protections, like protecting the right to organize, like making sure that workers can't get retaliated against, these are really, really important, because unions are the fabric of our country. And the Working Families Party and Joe Biden agree with, we agree on this point. Unions have built this country. They have made standards for workers across this country so good for our day-to-day lives. And so the elements of making sure that there's a right to organize, making sure that workers can actually live with dignity in the workplace, those are key elements of the American Jobs Plan and the Thrive Agenda. And that is why we need to pass the PRO Act. It is so, so critical and important. And so that's really, that's, you know, what we have. And I think that the bill, the American Jobs Plan, is actually one of the best labor bills we've seen in a really long time.
Peter in Huntington, you're on WNYC. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I guess my question from the middle here is, how do you pay for all of this? How do you pay for the infrastructure, for the jobs bill? These are tremendous, tremendous costs that obviously we don't have the money for, leveraging our children's future. And you're heading down a path, essentially, of socialism. I'm very familiar with this. My family escaped socialist Eastern Europe, which turned into communism. And what that leads to is just shared misery. And you see that in every socialist country around the world. So how do you pay for this without heading down a path of just making everybody equally miserable?
Before we get an answer from our guest, I'm curious, Peter, from your family's perspective with the experience that you were mentioning, how you view Western Europe democratic socialism or social democrats, where there's less poverty than the United States, they're still capitalist countries, they're still democracies, and the happiness level, quote unquote, in global surveys is seen to be higher.
In Western Europe, there's sort of a hybrid, but they still have the same issues. You know, they still grapple with the medical programs. The answer to that is rationing. So we don't like to talk about that too much here, but in Europe, that's what happens. Your medical programs are all rationed. And,
Peter, you know. thank you so much. Call us again. Of course, we ration healthcare too through the market. And other means, a lot of people don't have health care because the market rations in its own way. But Nalini, there is a widespread concern in the United States when people hear figures like $4 trillion, never mind $10 trillion, and the implications for debts and deficits and our children's tax rates. There certainly are countries around the world that have debt crises.
Yeah, so here's the thing. We spend trillions upon trillions, I believe 10 trillion even more, on war and the war economy. We've rolled back taxes on the wealthiest and corporations in the United States over the last half a century. And we actually have a history of having massive public investment. When we had the New Deal, we had a massive public investment because we had a massive, massive, massive crisis. And here's the thing, the stakes are just too high. I am continuously tired of seeing. I remember being there in the early days in New York of the pandemic, where our neighbors had to step up and make sure that some of us who got COVID, like myself, had food. I had to see people start GoFundMes for funerals because our stimulus checks stopped coming in, but our jobs never came back. We had to see people of Puerto Rico during Hurricane Maria giving each other clean water because Congress didn't take this chance to make our neighborhoods resilient to the climate disasters we know are coming. We have a history of public investment in our communities. This is nothing new. This is something that we actually have to do for everyone, because back then, Black, Brown, Indigenous people were not included, but we gave people housing. We gave people opportunities. And if this is supposed to be the land of opportunity, we need to prove that by making investments in our communities. I think it is quite strange to me that in the year that women, in December, women accounted, Black, Asian, Latina women accounted for 100% of job loss, but Jeff Bezos became a trillionaire in the same year. That is the level and the stakes that we are at. And that's why we have to have massive investment. So that is what we are focused on, because the consequences are too dire.
I just want to make sure we bring out the environmental aspects of this, the climate aspects of the bill, because that's certainly a big part for Biden and a big part for you. So I wonder if you could get specific about how you see the climate portion of the jobs plan, what's good in it, and what might you think is missing?
Biden's plan has good gains, but again, it's just wrong in scale. In order to cut climate pollution in half by 2030, we need massive investments across to the tune of $1 trillion per year, as we say, for the next 10 years. So there's the obvious ones that have been written in the plan: electric vehicles, modernizing and retrofitting buildings, which is great to be climate resilient, clean energy generation and transmission. There's also a critical piece so that we don't have crises like the Flint water crisis again, where in the plan it says that we will actually get rid of the lead pipes, make sure that people have access to clean water. Those are great parts of the plan. It is great. Great gains, but again, just wrong in scale, because we also have to have forest and wetland restoration. We have to make sure that we have regenerative agriculture. We need to put lots of people to work to take care so our communities are climate resilient. Those are really important things, and we have to learn We have to learn from the original stewards of the land, indigenous people, who have actually asked and demanded that we are in a relationship of consent and not just consultation with indigenous folks. And so for us, it is just critical that the extent of the climate crisis, because we are seeing a superstorm or a blizzard, every it's happening like clockwork. And we need to make sure that we're addressing these things at a level of scale that the climate crisis has been happening.
And on environmental justice, Biden says the jobs plan targets 40% of the clean infrastructure and other climate aspects to disadvantaged communities. So I hear you're saying that's a start. That's good. But you want more. I want to mention one other climate aspect before we move on. One thing that the environmentalist Sunrise Movement likes, I saw one of their leaders quoted on BuzzFeed, is Biden's Climate Conservation Corps, which would involve hiring, as you know, a lot of people to perform pro-climate work, like plugging abandoned oil and gas wells and many other things. And for people who know FDR's New Deal, this recalls his Civilian Conservation Corps, another CCC, which did a lot of environmental work in the 1930s, as well as employed people in the Great Depression. I'm curious if you have any thoughts about the Climate Conservation Corps in particular, or how you'd like to see it used.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is something that is a big win for organizations that we work with, like the Sunrise Movement, that demanded a Climate Conservation Corps. And we commend the administration for including it in there. I think, again, we have to just make sure that it goes bigger and bolder, because we just cannot continue to live crises, climate crises to climate crises. And if we saw anything like we did just a month ago or 2 months ago, what we saw in Texas, we need these jobs. We need the infrastructure now and immediately.
Nalini Stamp, the Brooklyn-based National Director of Strategy and Partnerships for the Working Families Party. Thank you so much for coming on with us.
Thank you so much for having me. Take care.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.